Part 3. Treason. During war, the laws are silent. Quintus Tullius Cicero. Chapter 42. Lysander. A chorus upon the pale. I run through the water I stole from Ajax's assassins in 2 days. Though heat stroke is unlikely due to my physiology, dehydration plagues me and obscures even the most basic mental and motor functions. Though my eye was not blinded by the firebrand due to avoiding its core flare, my vision is dreadfully impaired. 3 times I nearly lose my way when the features of the desert mislead me and I lose sight of the mountains, but I keep as straight a path north as I can, knowing I must eventually run into Erebos if I stay along the mountains. I could not accept Apollonius's help, but I might find some unaffiliated aid in Erebos. If I recover enough, I can decide how to reach Atalantia without chancing Ajax's interference. I eat the meat of cacti and suck the water from desert lotus, but I feel myself fading. I find myself wishing I were back on the Archie, listening to Cassius and Pytha bicker as I lie reading in my bunk. I wish Kalindora were with me, that she hadn't assumed I died. I wish Seraphina had simply stepped to the right. Only my anger at the desert itself keeps me going. Everything seems like a bleached mirage now. The sun is a malevolent fat troll that squats over the desert, burning any uncovered skin in 15 minutes and punishing me when I dare walk in the day. I sweat and sleep when I can find shade, and walk through the mornings when the plier is barren of grace. On my 4th day, I find the rotting carcass of a glass leviathan somehow swept in from the sea. The translucent flesh of the giant sea creature writhes with clouds of predatory blood flies and a wake of buzzards thick enough to blot out the sky. I steer well around it. When the northern storm sweeps rain showers over the desert, I lie down in joy to let it soothe my mangled face and the razor cuts Seneca and his men opened on my thighs and hip. Mercury is a lovely planet, with temperate coasts and mountain hotels and hot springs and cool valleys and coral seas, but to have all that, it had to have the hell of the Ladan around its equator. I curse the bastards that terraformed this planet. I curse the rocks, I curse the sun, the sand, myself, for needing so much gory damn water. And I curse Ajax. But more so, I curse the culture that let him grow wicked. The peerless scar was formalized by Selenius to mark a gold worthy of respect, not worship. Our rigorous institutes were built to educate us to be shepherds, not cannibals. The world provided Darrow to show us how far we'd lost our way. To fight him, we did not find our path again. We strayed further and further, learning all the wrong lessons. Gradually the desert gives way to a semi-arid climate as I make my way to more northern latitudes. The transition is subtle, barely noticeable at first, but even the smallest signs of life give me hope. Torrential rain has eroded hillsides, but also seduced weeds and flowers to spring out of the rocky soil. My vision returns enough in my right eye to see green interspersed with brown. The ground is still unforgiving and Spartan, but the worst danger is over. Where there is water, anyone can survive. Deerling with spiraling black antlers and birds shaped like fairies feed off the orange berries of gnarled geranium shrubs, only to zip home to their hive castles amidst cacti the size of houses. While I haven't the strength to hunt either with my razor, I eat as many berries as I can find among the thistles, never minding the cramps the excess fibre causes in my belly. I eat grubs from underneath boulders and swallow the yolks of bird eggs I find in low shrubs. Tubers and roots make the bulk of my diet, which causes more cramps, until I find a sulphur viper basking in the sun beneath a dead olive tree. I crush its head with a rock and drink its blood, knowing my immune system will likely handle the pathogens it carries. The mild nausea is well worth the valuable vitamins. When I've drained it, I roast its meter-long body over a fire. Its meat is tough and elastic, like Langsat flesh, but the calories give me fresh optimism as I make my push toward Erebus. Pausing on a ridgeline that leads to a fertile valley, I look back at the desert one last time. It waits there in the distance, patient, eternal, the graveyard of armies, but not me. I turn my back on it, but carry its lessons with me. The next kilometers are almost pleasant. While the temperature hovers around 50 degrees Celsius in the morning, frequent showers from the roiling clouds keep me cool and soothe the agony of my burn. Birds twitter in orderly citrus groves, which I eat heavily from as I pass. Following the tracks of an abandoned combine, I find a shed and a small farmhouse that looks to have been abandoned in haste. It has been looted at least once, and I am unable to find medical supplies. But in the garden, I find an aloe plant, which I am able to distill into a paste for my burn. It takes the sharp edge off the itching sting, but does little for the deep nerve trauma, and nothing at all for my eye, which throbs down to the very root of the ocular nerve. The power is out in the farm, but it is nice having a puzzle to solve that doesn't include imminent death. In a few hours, I'm able to rig the solar panels of the combine to work with the stove, on which I cook dry-pressed curry from a fresh can. I also manage to power the ancient HC in the living room. The HC won't link with the holonet, and instead shows only a society emergency broadcast message giving instructions for all citizens to evacuate Erebus and the surrounding lands for Naran, 100 kilometers northeast. I think of the tight showers on the Archi as I draw myself a bath. I slip into the cold water and shudder. It is the most pleasant thing I have experienced since the Calderium with Cassius. My legs are too long for the tub and splay out awkwardly against the fraying wallpaper. It's only then I realize how much weight I've lost. 20 kilos, maybe? My body looks like it belongs to a rust lung victim. It is emaciated, any skin exposed to the sun swollen and peeling. I doze lightly in the bath for hours. After drinking another liter of water, I collapse onto the former fab bed and sleep for an entire day. I set back out 2 mornings after arriving at the farm. I have changed the tattered pulse armor underlining for the farmer's clothing. I look ludicrous, the sleeves barely coming to my elbows and the pants to my shins. I look back at the farm, sorry to leave it, and wonder for a moment if I shouldn't just stay there. What am I rushing back to? A future as Atalantia's rival? A duel with Ajax when he must face what he has done? A short life of politics and betrayal? Revenge, which I don't want, even after Darrow took half my face? To be with my people? Why? Gold has grown sicker in my absence. But even knowing all that, there is still an undeniable itch to return, as if my spirit were drawn by gravity. I need to realize the promise I made to Dido, the excuse I gave to Cassius when I betrayed him. I must unite gold. More than that, I must change it. That is what makes me leave the farmhouse behind. That and the understanding that I must help liberate Kalindora, Rhone, and the Praetorians from Heliopolis. It would be immoral not to help those who risked all for me. By the good repair of Seneca's gear, it seems the Ash Legions weren't broken entirely. An invasion will be coming for Heliopolis, one I doubt my friends will survive. The walk to Erebus is leisurely compared with the desert. I cut through groves of wild cypress and orchards redolent with the smell of starheart blossoms. At times I see hovercraft on the horizon, or the occasional society patrol in the lower atmosphere, though black clouds brewed to the north, the worst of the storm seems to have passed. I pace myself, stopping frequently to gorge on the food I foraged from the farmhouse and the pack of tangerines pulled from the trees. My route takes me parallel to the Via Gloria, the white, frictionless highway that connects the cities that border the Ladan by land. It is broken by bombardment and littered with blackened Republic assault vehicles and desiccated corpses. I sleep under a grapefruit tree, and the next morning come across a family of sun-baked red natives walking along a country road, pushing a cart full of their life's belongings. They watch me approach with unease. I greet them politely and comment on the weather, as Mercurians always do. They look at each other, then up, and up at me and my melted face, and then they bow.
"Odd weather, yes, Dominus," the man says quietly.
"Devil weather,"
the woman says, with a little more heat, much to her man's distress.
"Greedy Martian. Thought he could break our spirit. Not this spirit, Dominus," the woman says. "A little weather won't tame us."
"Darrow, you mean?"
"Don't even give him a name, Dominus," she says bitterly. "His men ransacked our employer's latifundia. Took him away, saying he harboured the Fear Knight. Vale, bless the man. Did it all with smiles, of course. But when they were done, what have we got left? Just what they left us. We work for our share. We don't take the pity of Martian marauders." She spits. "Latifundia went to bits. Our head talk started running the place, but no one ever came for the hall. It's just sitting out there rotting."
"You with the legions?" she asks. "You look like you've seen Hades itself, Dominus." I scan the road behind her. "Only its gatekeepers."
"If there's anything you desire..."
Her eyes dart to my burned face, and she waves to her cart, again to her husband's distress. They barely have enough for themselves. "Just information. Have you seen any society forces?" I ask.
"Fear Knight's men were through here not too long ago, Dominus. Never know where you can find them, though. Like veiled spirits they are. Rest of the legions are out to the east, last I heard. A bastion set down. Here there be ash legions in Naran. It's flooding with refugees from Tyche and the coast. Poor souls. Whole city's gone. We're heading east to the riverlands. Here they're hiring folk out there for the clean-up."
"There's no legions in Erebos," I say in confusion.
"Erebos? It's drowned, Dominus," the man says.
I frown. The waves couldn't have come this far.
"What do you mean, drowned?"
By late morning I summit a hill that looks down into the valley of Erebos and see for myself. Erebos was a proud library city once, a serene and bucolic vanity created as a gift for my grandmother by the master-maker Glerastes. The high city, all in thrall to the great library, was hewn from the back of a low mountain just beneath a great dam. The dam protected the city from seasonal floods, caused by the melting of mountain snow, a quick affair under Mercury's sun. When I saw it as a child at Glerastes's side, I deemed it a giant turtle with a vine-wrapped city upon its back. He grumbled that it was a tortoise representing the patience and inevitable victory of knowledge. Now it is a watery necropolis. The great dam has broken, the pulse fields likely failing during the storm. The rush of water left a path of destruction across the city so thorough it would be a wonder if anyone survived. Carrion birds rule here now. There are no medical teams from either army, only bands of refugees across the flooded valley and plains beyond, trundling north in lines by the thousands. I sit down, finally feeling the exhaustion of the last week in my bones. Darrow has broken the planet. A sense of futility rises in me. What could anyone do to fix this? Resolving to refill my water and connect with one of the refugee trains, I stumble down the foothills, passing through forests entirely scalped by the wind. Not a tree stands. I wade through fields of lavender, where bees still pollinate, and draw to a halt. At the foot of the Via Gloria, a peculiar arrangement sprawls around the Arch of Octavia, which leads into the city. Even with my blurry vision, I know what it is. I walk down the hill. There beside the great archway, I find a scene of horror. Amongst a sea of lavender, the remains of more than 400 humans hang upon metal poles, blistering and naked, but for the wake of buzzards that clothe them in feathers of yellow and scarlet. The poles that puncture the humans are as thick as my wrists, sharp at the point and tapered. Each has been driven into the anal cavity of the victim to the point of perforating the mid-torso. In death, the legs droop, the back arches, the arms wing out and downward, and the head reclines backward, as if each victim perished in exultation. Sockets picked clean by the birds stare at the sky. A great hunk of stone stands at the entry to this atrocity, bearing the message, "Here lie Martians all, thralls of the slave king, who thought with wicked delight to take your planet's treasure and break their master's might. All ye who enter here witness their work and despair." The flooded city is their work, and the impalement ours. Is this what the society thinks will inspire the people to return to the fold? Atlas was no monster in the court of my grandmother. He was odd, always rather cold to me, and quick to leave the room when I entered. He despised children. Though he and Aja made Ajax together, their coupling entailed no relationship, from what I understand. In fact, Aja could barely stand the sight of the man. But I cannot believe my father's best friend would be this new monster. Though he was formerly a hostage, my grandmother trusted Atlas without equal. He spurned galas and festivals, and seemed only to stir himself from his library when my grandmother required his unique services. What they were, I never saw until now. I have always held in respect those golds who do not relish their station. Atlas never seemed to. Yet he has let his gorgons loose in ways that demean any claim we have to dignity. So my judgment on him is harsh. I stumble down the line to see the faces of the dead, thinking obscurely that someone should witness them here. All the families they represent, all the strands of life that are linked to theirs. Cruelty will travel down those lines, ensnaring more and more. No one has come to take them down. No footprints have even come within 100 meters. There is a whispering. It comes from a young red man. A sound comes from one of the red bodies, a whispering. He is alive. Barely more than a boy, a faint bit of hair covers his top lip. His cracked lips part, trying to say something more. I give him the remaining water from my pouches. Most of it spills down his chest. He tries to speak again. I edge closer to hear him.
They'll send me.
It's then I notice perhaps as many as a dozen still wheeze, their burned skin rising and falling with each insidious breath. I do not care if there are enemies, if impaling is an effective tactic, or even if they deserve this judgment, it is not the jurisdiction of any man to deliver it. I go closer to the boy. My mouth is so dry I barely manage the words. "Are you certain?" He cannot reply until I spill some of my water into his mouth.
"Send me."
There, so close to him, I can see the flecks of copper, brown, and even gold in his red irises. I feel a terrible sadness. I wish I knew that the eyes of his spirit looked upon his veil, that his ancestors were waiting for him in their cool highland valley. But I know it is not so, because I know the veil was created and cultivated by the Board of Quality Control in order to provide an important sociological prerequisite for obedience, a carrot at the end of a hard life. That very same belief that made them able to endure untold hardship in the mines, has become a militant faith. He begins to whisper as I draw my razor,
my love, remember the cries when winter died.
He is joined by the others until there is a rasping chorus there upon the pale. The Bellona razor's leather hilt is warm from the sun. Tension travels down my arm as the blade penetrates his chest and then his heart.
Go to your people, I whisper.
He jerks and then is still. More men and women beg for mercy down the line. I move to the next man. He's an older red with a thick beard shot with white and a face like a bulldog's. He begs for mercy. But when I stand in front of him, he and several others begin to laugh. I blink in confusion. Their faces swim in the heat. Why are they laughing?
Burn with us, you golden cunt,
he manages, from a mouth crusted with blood.
Burn with Mars.
Then I understand the trick. I do not move. I look down, knowing what it must be. I push lavender out of the way and blow down into the dirt. A thin mat of pressure-sensitive material lies under the topsoil. If I move my foot, the mine hidden beneath will make me a shower of meat. Even if I dive away, only 2 mines of the hundreds this war employs have a blast radius I'd be able to clear.
I was trying to help you, I say. I was trying to be decent.
The red just laughs, through teeth shattered to the nerve. Without a way to apply equal pressure to my weight on the pad, I dig a small tunnel through the dirt adjacent to the pad to reach the mine. Blindly reaching into the hole, I graze the side casing of the munition. It's a Lotus 13, judging by the octagonal top rim. If I can slide my razor between the pressure pad and the mine, I should be able to sever the hard wire connection. With hands shaking from adrenaline, I toggle the razor's edge to the thinnest setting possible, so the blade is narrow as a piece of paper, a hand's width wide. I slide it sideways down into the hole and trip a countermeasure. Bwee, bwee. Dirt and shredded lavender explode up into my face. And blast it upward. I lose my razor. The air rushes out of me as I land hard on my back. Something constricts around me, ensnaring. I push at it, but it cuts my fingers, and the more I push, the more it constricts. A tack net, I realize in relief. Not an explosive. But the relief is short-lived as I realize my predicament. I lie there in the morning sun, the only shade cast by the poles, the lavender stalks, and the bees. The meters to my razor and water might as well be 1,000. Every time I try to roll or wiggle closer, the net constricts more until it breaks the skin of my scalp. Soon I am immobilized, with blood trickling down my face. For hours I lie there as the sun traces its way across the sky, leaching my body of water as it forms blisters on my exposed skin. I'm the color of a tomato. The lavender sways, the bees buzz, the buzzards chew. I drift in and out of consciousness, woken only when the buzzards engage in a hearty squabble for a choice piece of thigh meat. The red man is dead. They feed on him. And watch me. If I could laugh, I would. Heir of Selenius, eaten by birds at the feet of reds, because he tried to be merciful. Lesson learned. It was my guilt for the Vindobona and the helpless people I left for the obsidians that distracted me. I should have known about the mines. I see those victims I abandoned now on the hill, lying in tack nets, watching me with smiles, waiting for me to join them in death. All those lives lost, so I could save Seraphina, who ran to her own slaughter with a smile.
"Well, look at this fresh catch," one of the victims says to me. "And a blood traitor by the looks of it," says another. "He killed some of the bait."
"Scar?"
heavy desert boots stop in front of me. A child's face bends down from the sky and peers into mine. Something is wrong. It is the colour of a dust moth's wings. Oh, it's a mask. Purple works its way into the mask as its wearer crouches near the lavender.
He's missing half his gory damn face. Eyeballs all mush.
A gloved hand twists my head.
No scar. We got ourselves a pixie, lads.
They're gorgons. Rising?
Who else? We don't send unscarred boys to battle. Let's leave him to bubble. This trap's done. Shit to show for it. Stragglers are all herded into Heliopolis for the big hammer.
One of them whistles.
Look at the detailing on his big iron. Skiantus made, bet my life. Slag off. How would you know what a Skiantus blade looks like? You wouldn't even be able to afford the hilt. The Minotaur had one. Treated it like a thirsty lady. Always running his fat mouth about it. See the flower petals? Where? Over the wing. If you say so. What's a pixie doing with a piece like that? If it don't fit, it's howler shit. Search him for trackers, and let's ride. Fear'll sort it.
The child's face looks down at me again as I try to speak.
Time to take a nap, traitor.
The last thing I see is his boot coming down.